Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Maverick scholar Mike Davis is an urban theorist and historian whose many books range from analyses of Los Angeles as the model of what he terms fortress cities to the history of the car bomb. Mike Davis will be coming to Memphis on October 8th to give a public lecture at Rhodes College at 7 p.m. about his book Planet of Slums, which he opens on a darkly pessimistic note.
The cities of the future, rather than being made of glass and steel as envisioned by earlier generations of urbanists, are instead largely constructed out of crude brick, straw, recycled plastic, cement blocks, and scrap wood. Instead of cities of light soaring toward heaven, much of the 21st century urban world squats in squalor, surrounded by pollution, excrement, and decay.
According to the United Nations, 1 billion people live in these fetid conditions, including 80% of those urbanites in the underdeveloped world. Mike Davis is with me today to help us understand our planet of slums and what we might do about it. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike, the range of your 20 books is really vast and impressive, and I'm just thinking of the nonfiction, not your novels. What are your main obsessions as a writer? What brings together this body of work?
Political passion and inordinate curiosity, I would say. I think in almost every article or book I've written, even in teenage adventure novels, has been in some way an attack on the moral legitimacy of the corporate ownership of the earth. I don't necessarily make a lot of friends with some of the books I've written.
Can you talk a little bit more about the way in which that focus on corporate ownership of the earth kind of comes together with environmentalism, how this shapes your understanding of the development of cities? Just sort of draw out what you've traced in a number of books.
In this complex project I've taken on, which is both a history of globalization since the mid-19th century, since the Victorian period, but also a multi-volume history of Los Angeles, particularly in the period where the economy underwent a transition to exports, internationalization, and its domestic manufacturers disappeared. In this complex project, I suppose one of the major themes has been that integration into the global market has been, since the 1870s and 80s in South Asia, northern China, Africa, something of an unmitigated disaster, trading subsistence crops for cash crops, increasing rather than diminishing vulnerability to drought and famine. And this first globalization, that of the era of the gold standard after the American Civil War, then sets the stage for understanding the later stages. Until the 1970s, urbanization was actually regulated, sometimes by dictatorial, certainly undemocratic methods across most of the developing world. China, of course, has a famous system that requires residence permits in order to live in the cities, but colonial cities, the British, French, Dutch empires, all limited access to the city and carefully segregated cities into European city and native city. Mexico City and Caracas conducted unrelenting wars on squatters all through the 1950s and early 1960s. But by the late 1970s, barriers to urbanization, to movement of rural people into the city, had fallen down across the world. And of course, city populations began to grow fast. Very, very fast, faster than counterpart Victorian cities during the Industrial Revolution. But at the same time, by 1980, the economies of these countries had contracted such high levels of debt and expenditures on investments, manufacturing, and so on, that turned out to be unprofitable, or in some cases, totally useless. And so urbanization became disengaged from industrialization, in fact, from the creation of formal employment per se. And under the so-called Washington Consensus, we're talking essentially about the consensus between the U.S. government under Carter and then Reagan and Bush with the leading global financial institutions, countries would be cut out of the world market unless they adapted draconian policies of reducing public expenditure, reducing public employment. So you had basically disinvestment in urban infrastructures and jobs going on at a time when cities were expanding at an absolutely unprecedented rate. And so the first question that has to be answered about our current urban world, majority urban world, is how did the city survive the 80s and the 90s? And the answer is they did in large part because the ingenuity and creativity of poor people, squatters who were able to create whole neighborhoods on vacant land, often in illegal occupations, people who we would consider unemployed, going out as street vendors, day laborers, domestics. But the burden of my little book, Planet of Slums, is that this frontier of informality has now closed. The only squattable land left in most of the developing cities of the world is land simply too dangerous to have any market value. Otherwise, land is a market transaction is everywhere. Majority of slum dwellers in most big cities are no longer owner-occupiers, they're renters. And finally, the informal labor market has become a kind of super Darwinian jungle with diminishing marginal returns to every new rickshawwala, laborer, street vendor. And as a result of so many people competing for survival and basically a relatively limited range of occupations, the role of ethnic militias and political machines and identity politics in rationing those opportunities has become more and more important. And I think one of the roots of sectarian violence in cities across the world is precisely the closing of these opportunities for successful informality, as economists call it.
You've already sort of skated now into giving us the big picture of Planet of Slums and the way in which your work sort of comes together in that context. And I really appreciate, as a historian, the way that you've given us a chronology of how we got here from the Victorian era to the present. But that's not exactly the way that the book is written. In fact, one of my colleagues, Elizabeth Thomas, I think beautifully described your book as more akin to Picasso's Guernica than to the usual social science fair that describes the kind of edge cities located on swamps or chemical dumps that you've been talking about. Do you agree with that comparison? Is Planet of Slums the Guernica of modern urban studies?
What I really did in Planet of Slums, and it's not very original, is that I was so impressed with the UN report, the Challenge of Slums. Most UN reports, of course, are not very memorable and often contain very little information. This is entirely different. This is a landmark study using census data and social indicators that hadn't existed before or never been applied to areas like the former socialist bloc. What I did is I just buried myself in several libraries for months. I read everything I could find in English and French, particularly on the twin subjects of squatting and housing in developing cities, and on unemployment and so-called informal job markets. And it just became glaringly apparent that the reliance on the poor to save themselves, to build cities out of nothing but their own sweat and dreams, but not only no longer realistic, but it became dangerous, a kind of romantic myth that the poor could do it all by themselves with microloans and, you know, a few demonstration projects, while the state was entirely abstracted from the process. And one of the central questions that, of course, arose is that of taxes. The middle classes in the developing cities of the world are incredibly undertaxed. Urban services and infrastructures are largely provided by regressive taxation. And so the problem is, even in cities where popular governments have taken power, where the poor have been, to use the current buzzword, empowered, government in their hands doesn't necessarily give them the means to make basic changes in life, to build schools, to create infrastructures that are missing, and above all, attack problems of sanitation. And I argue, predictably as a socialist, that only fundamental redistribution of economic power and wealth can achieve these goals. Otherwise, I warn that the descent into sectarian strategies of basically rationing the city's opportunities and limited resources may become the dominant mode, if it hasn't already in much of the world, the dominant mode of urban politics.
Well, these days, with Bernie Sanders as a Democratic Socialist running for president, I think more people are beginning to at least hear one version of that message. And I think also living in one of the few states, even in the United States, that has no income tax, some of what you're saying is certainly going to resonate with some listeners. Mike, in Planet of Slums, it's a multifaceted analysis, but you point the blame most emphatically when you write, I'm quoting you here, "Everywhere the IMF and the World Bank, acting as bailiffs for the big banks and backed by the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, offered poor countries the same poison chalice of devaluation, privatization, removal of import controls and food subsidies, and enforced cost recovery in health and education." Is this really the root cause of how we arrived at the Planet of Slums? And if that's the case, do you think that what you say of the Bush and Reagan administrations is just as true of the Clinton and Obama administrations?
Yes, it is. And what my argument really is that the impact of the trade policies and monetary rescue plans from the West was, first of all, most drastic in the countryside. And it's impossible to understand the crisis of the cities today without understanding the crisis of the countryside. In fact, I argue that in many cases, what we're dealing with is over-urbanization, unnecessary urbanization, simply because conditions in the countryside no longer afford subsistence, survival, and of course, typically lack any access to culture or education. So even knowing of the likelihood that if they migrate to the city, they'll end up in slums and in marginal economic positions, millions of people are still ready to take the risk. Certainly worth a gamble that might succeed in the city, that might get your kid an education, that might establish a small business, than to remain in a countryside where people are being displaced at an enormous rate, and which is also lost much of its integrity and identity. Certainly the villages still exist, but a remarkable phenomenon of the world has been the growth of a huge zone. Imagine a great peripheral circle around developing cities, an area that's neither country nor city. And most of the slum growth of the last 20 years has not been in the historic core of cities. It's been in the outer peripheries, you know, and often involves people who migrate back and forth between seasonal agricultural work and whatever work they can find. So the new poor, the new urban poor, are cut off from the traditions, the institution and public spaces of the classical city. And I give one example of that, which were the group of guys in Morocco who attacked businesses and Jewish cultural centers and five-star hotels, killing tourists and so on, all the time being amazed at what they saw. And none of them had been in the center of the city before. They'd grown up on the outskirts of Casablanca in this kind of neither world. And it's this slum periphery that's come to preoccupy, of course, military planners across the world, because much of this is essentially ungoverned, or it's governed only by the police. The role of city governments, regional governments, national governments, absolutely minimal in providing services to these alienated populations. So military planners recognize this as a fundamental strategic problem, making many of them into experts on urban affairs. Now, the role, the political role of the international economic financial institutions, which, of course, traditionally controlled by the United States, is incredibly important, but it's not the sole cause. I mean, basically what the Washington Consensus did is it inflicted a generation-long depression on Latin America, Africa, and parts of South Asia in order to repay banks. But the local elites who were complicit in these agreements negotiated them and who often became very wealthy because of it are, of course, an equally important factor. It was a collaboration, that ended up in so many cases with the death of jobs, the death of job creation. And even in countries that we consider the so-called BRIC countries, the medium income, fast-growing countries like take Brazil or South Africa, for example, growth, urban growth, even economic growth, has gone hand in hand with deindustrialization. Mexico is another example. Yes, huge auto plants in northern Mexico, but much larger number of home market manufacturing jobs destroyed in the center. And the success of certain countries, and again, take South Africa or Brazil, and being able to provide income supports or undertake some significant reforms to the poor, it's almost entirely dependent upon export revenues of primary commodities consumed by China. And China is finally the last gigantic fact that sits here, because the urban industrial revolution in China dwarfs anything that had gone before it, basically obliterated the pathway for industrialization that countries like Korea and Taiwan and so on had followed, Mexico to some degree, in the 1950s. You know, you start out with sweatshop industries, garment, textiles, light industry, and you move up the food chain. But China simply has the capacity, the state organization, and the massive resources to become the factory for the entire world. So you've had countries who've really converted their economies into sourcing China's urban industrial revolution and leaving themselves incredibly vulnerable, as we see right now, to any slowing, much less any downturn, of economic growth in China.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. I'm talking with Mike Davis, who will be joining us in Memphis on October 8th for a public lecture at Rhodes College at 7 p.m. Mike, I want to talk about some of the ways in which these urban slums that you talk about rimming the entire world get impacted by some of the ways in which they come back home. So, for example, you talk about how mega spectacles that we love to watch, like the Olympics and World Cup soccer tournaments, have dreadful consequences for those living in slums. What is the impact of these mega spectacles?
Well, the Olympics, World Expositions, Commonwealth Cups all become huge pretexts for massive urban renewal. They allow urban regimes, national regimes in some cases, to carry out plans that otherwise would be politically untenable or would face massive popular opposition. And there are just huge number of studies, starting with things like the Seoul Olympics a generation ago, but covering all the major mega events of the last 20 years. And hundreds of thousands of people lose their homes, displaced. I mean, Beijing Olympics was really one of the most brutal forms of urban renewal I think anyone has ever seen. It just allowed them to uproot traditional neighborhoods, working class neighborhoods in the center of Beijing. And then after the games were over, and you'd created this image of national prowess and competence, then you had the land to commit to other uses, to office towers, to luxury housing. So poor urban dwellers around the world have every reason to fear such mega events. Even in Los Angeles, the Olympics in the 1980s were used to create a kind of cordon sanitaire around the USC campus and the LA Coliseum. It led to almost overnight a gentrification of a number of neighborhoods that the university and city planners had considered to be blighted, the term that's always used for places where poor people live.
You've already flagged the issue that one of the ways that urban environments are being impacted is by military planners thinking about the way in which these unequal conditions can end up being regulated. You write at one point, it's become commonplace for governments everywhere to justify slum clearance as an indispensable means of fighting crime. Can you elaborate a little bit on how you see the relationship between policing and slums, and I guess some of the way this is playing out in the U.S. now in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement?
Police have always been first and foremost guardians of private property, but in many parts of the world, Rio de Janeiro, for example, the police themselves are the criminal gang, and indeed a far more dangerous one. The employment crisis, which I argue is the foremost and most profound challenge that we face in the future, has of course led to a huge rise in subsistence crime amongst young males marginalized or displaced from the labor market. But it's police brutality, police corruption, police crime that is the bigger societal problem. And this is what countries like Mexico, for instance, have lost total control over. and you have corrupt police forces controlled by organized crime or simply controlled by wealthy developers and city renewers, they become the enemy of poor and increasingly of the middle classes as well. And, of course, Rio de Janeiro is now probably the most important case study in the relationship between street crime and gangs on one hand and police on the other, where the police are used to literally clear out favelas, traditional favelas, classical favelas close to the center, where real estate values would appreciate by, you know, exponentially if those areas were available to gentrification. And this is carried out quite openly in Brazil, and it's led to displacement of more and more people from the center to the periphery. Same thing plays out in other megacities like Manila or Jakarta, both Indonesia and the Philippines, been incredibly ruthless in just evicting people from traditional neighborhoods, sometimes just taking squatters out and dumping them in the countryside miles and miles from their former homes. And the police play a role in this entire process. And it's very hard to talk about how you would reform the police when police tend to be very poorly paid in most of the world. The profits of police crime are very great. Police in Rio de Janeiro, for instance, moonlight is private security that often takes the form of simply going out and assassinating known street criminals in the neighborhood. And people, of course, get hardened to this reality. And the middle class retreats into its fortress apartment towers, its gated suburbs, or leaves the city entirely. In Buenos Aires, you have this whole phenomenon of people who've moved to their country clubs and developed luxury housing divisions about their country clubs, place they'd normally in the past would have gone to only on a Saturday or Sunday, and now live out there and commute to the city because of the security it offers. And it's dividing the urban world. It's creating, in the process, almost two humanities, because the rich and the upper middle classes have basically seceded from the common life of the city and from responsibilities for public space and public services.
Now, if I think about my students trying to consider how it is that end up making a difference, one avenue is through NGOs, but you actually indict NGOs for what you call soft imperialism. What do you mean by that?
NGOs have become a means for contracting out responsibilities that should fall on the central government or the municipal government. They've become, and this is how, of course, the old-fashioned political machines worked in eastern industrial cities in the United States, means of dispensing welfare to those who are loyal or those who've shown capacity for upward mobility, but denying it for others. NGOs become a facade, a mantra of bootstraps, self-help, hope, and slumdog millionaires to hide other reality. The indictment isn't against NGOs per se, but the larger NGOs, the corporate-funded, the large philanthropy NGOs, ones that are covertly government-sponsored, and of course the United States foreign policy has turned toward, you know, massive reliance and support of NGOs, are a means of indirect and basically undemocratic government. And these charges are made by traditional NGOs, by parties of the left and populist movement. India alone has produced actually enormous literature of critique of the NGO experience there. So it's not an abstraction that NGOs are bad, but it's a reality that NGOs have been instrumentalized, manipulated, and used in ways that directly contradict their avowed purposes of, for instance, sanitation, women's health, but particularly housing, employment, training.
Throughout the book, in the course of your analysis, you flash back to the Victorian age, which you've written about in Late Victorian Holocausts. I think that title says a lot. Why is this historical reference to the 19th century valuable and important? Why is it so important that you flash back to the 19th century and then forward to the present?
Because the slum, the classical slum of the 19th century, the slums of Manchester, Chicago, or for that matter, Dortmund and Albany, were industrial slums. There were slums full of people who worked in factories or sweatshops or dug under the earth in mines, and whose lives were potentially transformable by self-organization, by unions, as indeed happened in so many cases. So the classical industrial slum doesn't fit at all with today's slum. But there are two cities in Europe very much like modern slums. and they were Dublin and Naples, both cities that became deindustrialized at the beginning of the 19th century, the collapse of luxury trades in Naples, the collapse of cotton manufacture in Dublin. So they became huge repositories of the poor. And other cities in Europe might have followed the same path. Europe might have had slums that looked very much like those of the 21st century. But of course, there was the safety valve of immigration. So the displaced or redundant farm laborers in Poland or the west of Ireland could go to Berlin and work in factories, go to Liverpool and work on the docks, or for those who had the means could immigrate to North America or Argentina. And although today it seems like immigration is at an all-time height, in fact, there's far too little immigration, particularly given the skewed demographics of the future. For older industrial countries will become even older. Their working forces will collapse with a desperate need of new labor. While in the fastest urbanizing area in the world, which is West Africa, it's the development of a super city system of 60, 70 million people. The proportion of youth is very high. There aren't too many people on this planet, but there is a very maldistribution of population relative to economic and human needs. And immigration and the universal citizenship of people is absolutely crucial, I think, to, you know, civilizational survival. And the question that's put so bluntly in front of our faces now by the immigration wave from the Eastern Mediterranean to Europe, is that a triage? Are we going to abandon a significant part of humanity as the societies are destroyed, the cities become unlivable, or as environmental crisis reduces the capacity of countrysides to support rural populations, never forgetting the world is still almost half rural, or for that matter, that most of the urban growth in the future won't occur in megacities, it will occur in medium-sized cities whose names nobody is probably familiar with and are almost entirely ignored, you know, by urbanists. In conclusion, it was Dublin and Naples that foreshadowed the 21st century city and the urbanization of poverty, not the classical industrial slum of the north of the Midlands or north of England.
As I've been listening to you, Mike, engage in this analysis, I've been honing in on some of the moments in which you're proposing some important solutions to your diagnosis of the ailment. That is, you've spoken about the need for truly progressive taxes, unionization or movements of solidarity, ideas of universal citizenship. But if one looks at the critiques of your writing, you've been criticized for being both too pessimistic, even apocalyptic, and for being too utopian. How do these two prevalent critiques work, and how do you respond to them?
Well, I think they must be products of my failure as a writer to express ideas quite clearly. I mean, in my books on L.A., I wrote a book on L.A. called The College of Fear that was precisely a critique of the imagination of disaster, turning social, seeing natural events as social events, this feeling that there was a, you know, kind of a subterranean apocalypse under all the prosperity. And I tried to show how that served specific political aims. I don't really think in terms of dystopia and utopia. My position, my starting point is just very simple, to think in terms of the necessary and reject any compromise with what's realistic if it doesn't accomplish what's humanly necessary to guarantee socially meaningful jobs to people on this planet and a reconstruction of the urban environment. The amount of work and investment to make our cities able to survive a new geological epoch, a new climate, to prevent the kind of pandemics that might occur, and above all, to turn the next 1.5 billion people from a burden into our salvation. The Earth's population will top out probably when my youngest children are about my age. They'll never get bigger again. And I emphasize that there aren't too many people. But if we don't create jobs and educate this next 1.5 billion people, we will lose all the creativity and imagination that can solve these problems. My position is quite simply to speak in the name of the necessary, however implausible or unrealistic it might seem.
And so many of these issues that you raise in the course of your work really are invisible, or they percolate up for a brief news flash and then they're gone. One of the real virtues of your work is that you connect these dots, and in Planet of Slums, you connect them between India and Brazil and South Africa. And we're looking forward to you bringing this home to us in Memphis. Thank you so much for being with us today to start a conversation. We'll continue at Rhodes College on October 8th at 7 p.m. It's been really good to talk to you, Mike Davis.
Thank you.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.